Welcome to Cancer Conference Update, ESMO Congress 2025. Today we're focusing on urothelial bladder cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Terrence Friedlander from the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of California, San Francisco, in San Francisco, California. So we're going to start out with this late-breaking abstract from the Potomac trial. You want to talk a little bit about kind of what they were looking at here, what they saw, and what you think it means?
Sure, yeah. So this is the Potomac study, which compared durvalumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, with BCG, compared to BCG alone in patients who were newly diagnosed with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So BCG has been the standard of care here for about 40 years. Nothing has yet beaten BCG, and this was seeing if we could improve the outcomes. Now, this comes in the background of the CREST trial, which was a study of sasanlimab, which is a subcutaneous PD-1 agent that was reported earlier this year and had about a hazard ratio of 0.68 for event-free survival. This really comes on the heels of that. This was a three-arm study. There's a control arm of BCG induction and maintenance. There is the treatment arm of BCG induction maintenance plus durvalumab. And then there was this intermediate arm of durvalumab and BCG induction only. That study, I think, was not, it wasn't positive, so I'm not sure we should spend too much time talking about that middle arm. But enough to say that the addition of durvalumab here in the study resulted in a positive trial, so essentially a positive event-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.68, so about a 32% reduction in risk of having recurrence here. When they looked at overall survival, the study is somewhat immature, so we don't yet see a difference in overall survival. There may be a slight splaying of the curves. Definitely need more time. I think some of the controversy here is, perhaps if patients get a PD-1 agent later in the disease course, maybe survival will never be positive. When you looked at the that intermediate arm that I mentioned, where they got durvalumab BCG induction only and no BCG maintenance, we didn't see a statistically meaningful difference. And then when we looked at toxicity, this is basically what you would expect if you're giving a PD-1 inhibitor to a patient with, relatively healthy patient. So you see slight increases in some of the common things, hypothyroidism, rash, that you wouldn't expect if you were just giving BCG alone. But it didn't really seem like the amount of dysuria was markedly higher or the amount of urinary infection. So overall, it was fairly safe with the rare, serious adverse toxicity that happens with PD-1 inhibitors.
They also didn't really report a correlation with PD-1 status. Any feedback you're receiving from both your GU oncology investigator colleagues and particularly urologic oncologists?
So this really, as I mentioned, comes on the heels of the CREST trial. So I think urologists and med-oncs have already been thinking about this for a little while. And the big question is the juice worth the squeeze here? Is giving the PD-1 very early, is that really helping patients? And it clearly is helping to prevent disease recurrence. But as I was sort of alluding to earlier, it's not that clear that that necessarily results in more cures long term or more, better survival. I think the concern, even though PD-1 inhibitors are fairly safe, the concern here is that this is a patient population that's normally treated by urologists that never see a medical oncologist until, they develop more advanced disease, muscle invasive or metastatic. So, it's not really clear who's going to be giving this drug. Will it be community urologists? And if so, do they have the expertise to manage autoimmune side effects? Some are mild, hypothyroidism, you give replacement thyroid hormone, but serious adverse events do happen. There's about, probably a less than 1% chance of dying from PD-1 inhibitors and serious, another serious toxicity like myocarditis, pneumonitis, et cetera. So I think the jury's a little bit out here in terms of what is the value of giving PD-1s early? Clearly, it reduces the risk of disease recurrence, but does it actually generate longer-term benefit? I think we still need to see that.
So in terms of your point about who's going to do it, what do we know right now about who's giving IOs, with BCG-resistant in situ disease?
So I'm not sure I have like nationwide data. I can tell you in most academic centers, it's medical oncologists who are doing this in partnership with urologists. Most of my urology colleagues, you know, they want to be in the OR. They don't necessarily want to be giving PD-1s and managing autoimmune toxicity and steroids. There may be urologists who are quite savvy who can do this. Internationally, urologists treat with chemotherapy and other things in many other countries. So it's not impossible. I think there's just a certain amount of training that may be needed, especially for urologists who aren't used to giving systemic therapy.
So how about the very much awaited phase 3 KEYNOTE-905 trial?
Yes, so this is an exciting study. We're all waiting for this. So KEYNOTE-905, also known as EV-303, I tend to refer to the study as both. So this is a study that combines enfortumab vedotin, which is a Nectin-4-directed antibody-drug conjugate, has MMAE as the payload. It's already approved for metastatic disease as monotherapy late line, and then it's approved with pembrolizumab and is the standard of care in the frontline metastatic space, both for cisplatin-eligible and for cisplatin-ineligible. And as soon as those studies were launched, you know, the big question was, why do we wait for a patient to develop metastases before we get them exposed to EV and pembro, because the data in the metastatic setting looks so good? And so that formed the basis for this KEYNOTE-905 trial, which is looking at patients who are ineligible for cisplatin, the normal standard of care for a patient with muscle-invasive bladder cancer who is eligible for cisplatin is to give them 4 cycles of cisgem or 4 rounds of Dostenza MBAC and then take them to surgery and then consider adjuvant PD-1s. This is the first study, a phase 3 study, that's looked at giving neoadjuvant PD-1 and it's substituting enfortumab vedotin for cisplatin. And so as you can see in the study design, this actually was a fairly complicated study in the sense that it started as a pembrolizumab monotherapy phase 3 trial and was amended over the course of the trial to add an enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab arm. And then there were some modifications made during the pandemic, et cetera. Nonetheless, they were able to accrue the number of patients needed to do a clean comparison of EV pembro as neoadjuvant therapy for 3 cycles, followed by surgery, removing the bladder, followed by 6 adjuvant cycles of EV and pembro again. And that was all compared to just observation. Now, the standard of care for the observation arm changed during the course of this study because the CheckMate 274 trial of adjuvant nivolumab was positive. And so this study, about halfway or 3/4 of the way through, allowed patients in the observation arm to get adjuvant nivolumab. So it's not a perfect comparison. Nonetheless, when you look at the survival curves, it's pretty dramatic. This generated a huge round of applause, a standing ovation at ESMO. The hazard ratio here was 0.4 for event-free survival. So that's a 60% reduction. And the study was positive for overall survival with a hazard ratio of 0.5. So patients were twice as likely to be alive if they got 9 perioperative cycles of EVP. In terms of adverse events, we didn't really see any new adverse events that we didn't know about compared to the metastatic setting. I think there was concerns about wound healing from surgery, you know, how patients would do in the perioperative setting. And, you know, long story short is that we didn't see that this was prohibiting patients from getting to surgery or really impairing wound healing to any significant degree. We do see common things like rash and neuropathy are quite common with EV, and we're seeing them at about the same rates here.
So they reported a really impressive PathCR rate of 57% with EV pembro, and I believe there's sort of a companion study of patients eligible for cisplatin.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a study that is comparing EVP versus 4 cycles of cisgem. Again, it's what we call the sandwich approach, where they get neoadjuvant chemotherapy followed by adjuvant. A lot of criticism about that because, you know, there's no real contribution of components like investigated here. Is the neoadjuvant sufficient? Is the adjuvant sufficient? Do you have to give both? And we can maybe talk about that a little bit more. You know, the patient population for this trial is cisplatin ineligible patients. So these are patients who are more frail, either have bad kidney function, they were, you know, not as good performance status or other factors like hearing loss that preclude the use of cisplatin. So I think it's quite impressive to see such a dramatic, you know, improvement in this patient population that's fairly sick, recognizing that the control arm was essentially observation with just a sliver of patients getting adjuvant nivolumab. I think the challenge with this trial, as I said, was the contribution of components, because as you can see, peripheral neuropathy happens in a third of patients. And in my experience, the peripheral neuropathy can be long lasting. So if we could get away with giving just three cycles of neoadjuvant, that would be great, right? Then we would probably have much less rates of neuropathy. And I think one of the major points of discussion from this trial was actually looking at patients who had complete clinical responses, which was almost 60% of the trial. Patients had no cancer left after getting TURBT and three cycles of neoadjuvant therapy. There was also a cell-free DNA component to this trial, which I think is going to be better investigated in later updates. But, you know, there could be a future in which we take patients who are in a complete clinical response, cell-free DNA negative, and then say, hey, wait, do you really need all this adjuvant therapy? And we don't really have the strongest data yet to say, no, you shouldn't give it. I think the standard should be to follow what they did in the study. But I think it gives us a lot of room to investigate maybe more like sort of risk-adapted approaches that try and minimize toxicity.
Would you like to hazard a guess in terms of what you think we're going to see when we see the comparison of EV Pembro to cisplatinum gemcitabine?
I think it's probably going to be a positive study. I'm an investigator on the trial, but I don't have access to the high-level data. I do think it's going to be positive just because EVP, you know, was so much more effective in the metastatic setting that I'd have a hard time believing that it's not going to be that effective versus cisgem in the perioperative setting, but we need to see the data.
I was initially stunned when I just saw the EV, you know, the metastatic data with EV Pembro compared to cisplatinum gemcitabine. So, but at this point now, I think people are expecting now whether it's going to have a survival benefit and all these other things and what the magnitude is, I guess that's another question.
Yeah, it also depends on the availability of EVP in the metastatic setting. It's not approved yet in every country. The UK just got it. It's been, you know, it's been available in the US for a number of years. Right. So there's a lot of factors that go into, you know, looking at survival in these bigger studies. Even if the people get subsequent EVP, we know in bladder cancer there's attrition of patients from the localized setting to the M1, the first metastatic setting, to the second line, to the third line. There's rapid attrition of patients. So I think the thing that I've learned in treating bladder cancer is if you can give the therapy to the patient earlier, that's probably better, you know, having the trial data behind you rather than waiting for relapses, because sometimes you miss the opportunity.
Any thoughts or maybe you already have experience from these trials in terms of how people tolerate a perioperative or neoadjuvant EV Pembro? I mean, what fraction of patients really, you know, they need the drug held? You know, which drug is the one that's usually the culprit? I'm assuming it's usually enfortumab. And how often do you see people really run into issues just with a few cycles?
Yeah, so speaking more from my experience in the metastatic space, you know, it's about half of patients or more will need a dose reduction by cycle 8. And both these two trials in the perioperative space are looking at like 9 cycles of therapy. So, you know, I think the majority of people in the perioperative space will need dose reductions, dose holds. The neuropathy is what I worry about the most. The skin toxicity is pretty manageable. There's rare pneumonitis and things like that. So it's sort of like a Goldilocks thing here where it's like how much EV is too much, how much is too little. There's so much we don't understand about EV. Like, can you select patients? You know, the data from the metastatic studies suggest that all patients respond. My read of the data is that higher Nectin-4 levels are associated with somewhat better long-term outcomes. But, you know, is that going to apply in the perioperative space? I think the cell-free DNA is, as we're going to talk about probably with IMvigor011, is really going to help guide us in terms of our use of these therapies and really, you know, allow us to hopefully kind of risk stratify and tailor therapy so we're not overdosing people on EV and generating all this neuropathy that then the patient has to live with for the rest of their life.
All right. So Sunrise 4. As a medical oncologist, I really love the TAR-200, you know, device there, the pretzel, so to speak. And I've been waiting to see whether or not it's going to actually come into practice. Any comments about this late-breaking abstract from ESMO?
Yeah, so TAR 200, for those who don't know, is essentially a biomaterial that contains gemcitabine in a solid core. It can be administered as a linear tube into the bladder via cystoscopy, and then it auto-assembles into a pretzel shape, sits in the bladder for 3 weeks up to 3 months, and slowly releases gemcitabine. And there's been great data we've seen in the non-muscle invasive space, because essentially it allows us to continuously give gemcitabine. So this study was looking at a combination of TAR 200 plus sotrolimab, which is an anti-PD-1 antibody, and compared it to sotrolimab alone. This is a phase 2 trial, and was trying to understand what the effect of this is in patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer who were either ineligible or refusing cisplatin-based chemotherapy. So this kind of runs up right against the KEYNOTE-905 study that we just discussed. It's a very similar patient population. So here, you know, when they looked at pathologic CR rates, it was 38%. In the other study I just mentioned, it was 57%. So I think, you know, not that we should compare across style trials like this, at least not with a statistically valid, you know, voice. But anyway, there was a decent benefit, but, you know, not dramatic. And if you look at the PCR rate with just TURBT and the PD-1 alone, it was 28%. And then when you look at recurrence-free survival, there was a benefit to adding the TAR 200, sort of a modest benefit in terms of recurrence-free survival. So again, this was only about 120 patients, so it's kind of small. The side effect profile of TAR 200 is mostly related to cystitis, so it just irritates the bladder. Fortunately, grade 3 events were actually quite rare. And so in the absence of the KEYNOTE-905 data that we just discussed earlier, you know, this would have been maybe one of the most promising therapies for patients who are ineligible for cisplatin. I think the jury is still a little bit out on whether this is necessarily going to get to a phase 3 or how impactful a phase 3 would be if we saw the similar data, given that we now have KEYNOTE-905. It is attractive because a urologist can give all this therapy theoretically. I mean, obviously, probably want a med onc giving the PD-1, but the urologist can be quite involved here. And so there's some value to this. I think this is probably one of the trials that was the hardest to fit into our treatment landscape, just because it's qualitatively different. And I would say the data from phase 2 was not as overwhelming, to me at least, as the data from the phase 3 KEYNOTE-905.
Have you had any of your patients receive this therapy? I mean, to me, it seems like it'd be a lot easier than going through EV Pembro, but you tell me, how is it for the patient?
No, it is. I'm an investigator on the Sunrise 5 trial, so I won't say specifics about any patient in that trial. But, you know, from what we've seen of the TAR 200 program in general, I would say this is pretty reflective. Like, most patients tolerate this fairly well. There's some, you know, cystitis, some sort of uropathy, but overall that's actually fairly well tolerated. I think we'd love to see this study and, like, you know, longer term outcomes, longer follow up. Overall survival needs to be looked at. Even the event-free survival was not a primary endpoint here. So I think we need a little bit more data to know where this fits. I think for the NMIBC space, though, the Sunrise program, the TAR 200 program, has a lot of legs. Because we've seen quite good evidence that that's fairly effective, especially in BCG refractory patients. So there's really a lot of opportunity there.
So it looks like, at least in this trial, if I'm reading this correctly, that they get this, have to have a cystoscopy with the insertion of this pretzel like 4 times over 12 weeks. Is that?
Yeah, so it was every 3 months. And that's the sort of the beauty of the TAR 200. It can stay in for up to 3 months. You know, because patients don't want to have a cystoscopy that frequently. Although this can be an office cystoscopy, it's quite easy, from what I understand from my friends in urology, to insert this and remove it. So it's you know, there's something attractive about doing this mostly in the urologist's office.
All right, so here are two more papers. You know, the whole issue of adjuvant IOs has been really interesting over the last few years. And you kind of, I think you could maybe see this coming about how it was going to end up. Specifically now, I guess, maybe really involving ctDNA. So yep. Let's hear a little bit about more data from Dr. Powell's IMvigor011, and then some interesting data from CheckMate 274.
Sure. Yeah, so the adjuvant space, as you say, is quite interesting. Currently, nivolumab is approved based on CheckMate 274 as adjuvant therapy in the U.S. and for PD-L1 high in Europe. Pembrolizumab also had positive data in the Alliance Ambassador study led by Andrea Paolo. And then we have the IMvigor study. So just sort of breaking them up, the IMvigor trial was a follow-on to IMvigor 010. This is IMvigor 011. The IMvigor 010 study took all comers who had muscle-invasive bladder cancer and were considered high risk by either having muscle-invasive or extravesicular disease, depending on whether or not they got some neoadjuvant chemo. So they were considered high risk for recurrence. IMvigor 010 showed that there's a all-comers population, atezolizumab wasn't effective in preventing recurrences compared to monitoring. But in the patients who were cell-free DNA positive after surgery, they were considered a high-risk population, and there was a benefit in 010 in those patients who got atezo versus placebo or versus control. In this trial, they really drilled in on that, and they said, let's do a prospective study to understand the value of cell-free DNA. And this study is a little tricky because patients who were cell-free DNA negative after surgery were not treated and were just put on surveillance. Patients who were cell-free DNA positive at any time in the 1 year after surgery, so it wasn't at their very first visit. They could have turned positive, you know, 6 months later. Then they were randomized to atezo or placebo. So in a sense, it's kind of looking at giving atezo early in patients with cell-free DNA detection and asking what's the value of the cell-free DNA. And so what we saw in the trial was that if a patient's cell-free DNA turns positive after surgery and they get atezo, they do much better than if they don't get any therapy at all. And I think this is maybe not surprising. I think cell-free DNA is almost like a rising PSA for those out there who treat prostate cancer. And it's an early sign that the cancer is coming back. We know that when it's positive, almost everybody relapses. Not everybody, but almost everybody. So when you look at event-free survival and when you look at OS, there's clearly a benefit here. Hazard ratio for survival was like almost 0.6. This applied regardless of when the cell-free DNA test was done, whether it was initial or subsequent, sort of at a later time point. But the patients did need to be followed and then treated. I think the data that was presented earlier this year was looked at what happened to the cell-free DNA negative patients, and it was about 88% of them were cured. 12% of them still relapsed with a negative cell-free DNA, so it's not a perfect biomarker. When we looked at toxicity here, there was really no difference compared to many other studies of atezo. We see, you know, pretty common autoimmune toxicities, but I think this was tolerable like it is in just about every other trial of atezo, or PD-1 for that matter.
So I know there are a lot of new cell-free DNA MRD trials, and the assay here was Signatera.
It's a bespoke assay. The tumor was sequenced, and then probes were designed on that patient's very specific mutations, and then that was looked for in the blood. So there is a, you know, that this IMvigor 011, just to add, was really a very important study because of its a use of a prospective biomarker like cell-free DNA. I think it was nice to see atezo works, but we know these PD-1s work in the adjuvant setting. I don't think it really changed the bar in the use of PD-1 in that space, but really helped us understand that you can use cell-free DNA to risk stratify people. And the big question is, how does that apply across all of bladder cancer? Like, should we be using that to assign EVP therapy? Or there's other trials in the process. Like, will that be helpful for assigning adjuvant chemo, like platinum chemo? So it really almost sort of opens up. It's great to see, and congrats to Tom Poles and the entire team for getting this over the line. Switching gears, the CheckMate 274 study has been published already. This is a phase 3 trial looking at nivolumab versus placebo for 1 year as adjuvant therapy. At ESMO, we didn't really see major updates. I think everyone was hoping to see a confirmed survival benefit. It's been trending in favor of survival for many years, where there's clearly a DFS benefit. It seems to accrue more to the PD-L1 positive patients. It's a little controversial in bladder cancer. So that wasn't a surprise. Then the OS, again, was sort of trending in the right direction, but not finalized. The toxicity was really no different than almost any other study of nivolumab, common IO toxicities here. What they were able to show in the study was that they had some patients, it was only about 18% of the study, that had cell-free DNA assayed in CheckMate 274. And so as a correlative, Makulski, who presented this, presented some of their cell-free DNA data, and it was very much in line with what we're seeing in IMvigor 011 and other trials, which is that if a patient's cell-free DNA positive, they tend to be at higher risk for recurrence and tend to benefit more from getting adjuvant therapy than someone who's cell-free DNA negative. The numbers were super small, though, so we have to take it with a grain of salt. The CheckMate 274 study was an older study, and I think it wasn't necessarily, you know, the focus of the trial to look at cell-free DNA. So there was only one time point done, which kind of limits the scope and the power of the biomarker.
So I'm curious whether you think, you know, quote, this is ready for prime time. Are you going to get cell-free DNA? If you can, you know, get it paid for, are you going to go ahead with this strategy? And if you do, are you going to use the Signatera? And one of the reasons I bring this up is, you know, you can use a non-bespoke assay, you know, just, which is, you know, I guess just looks at a bunch of biomarkers. And one of the advantages is you get the results back quicker because the Signatera right. takes a little bit longer. I hear docs say these patients want to be treated and they're, you know, whatever, it's hard to get them. But, you know, they've gotten used to doing that with other assays. But I am curious whether you would like to actually implement this strategy in your practice. And if so, what assay you're going to use?
Yeah, so we already use cell-free DNA fairly commonly in the metastatic setting, and I use it almost like a PSA in a man with advanced prostate cancer, where it's, even though it's not really been validated there, if the cell-free DNA is going up, I might image the patient sooner, I might pay more attention to, you know, even small symptoms that normally might not generate an entire workup, because I worry about them progressing. And so, you know, the data, the initial data that was generated for cell-free DNA in bladder looked very strong. This was by a group in Denmark, where in the perioperative space, patients who were cell-free DNA negative, almost all of them were cured, and patients who were positive, almost all relapsed. So I do think IMvigor011 really shows us that there's value to looking at cell-free DNA and risk stratifying patients. For the positives, they should definitely be getting adjuvant therapy because they're almost by definition going to all relapse. The question is for the negatives, what to do? Because I mentioned about 12% of negative patients relapse. So are you going to withhold therapy in those patients and then treat them when they turn positive? Or should we just be treating everyone? I think the jury is still out on that. You know, in breast cancer, you know, we'll give adjuvant therapy for a 1%, you know, improvement in outcomes, or at least that's the way it seems to me as a non-breast cancer expert. So if you have 11% of patients or 12% of cell-free DNA negative patients still relapsing, I think that might be a call to give adjuvant therapy, understanding the overtreatment of patients, the cost of doing all that, you know, and the problems. So I think we still need to wrap our heads around this a little better. And then whether to use a bespoke assay or not, I've been using the Signatera assay. Most of my colleagues have as well, because the majority of the data has really been built on that in prospective trials in bladder. I'd love to see maybe better data in larger cohorts of a non-bespoke assay to look for cell-free DNA to really see if the data holds up, because, you know, these are all tools and they're all slightly different, and we really want to make sure we're using the right tool, you know, for the right job.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking about breast cancer as you were talking about this, because we were very involved very early in the when the Oncotype came out. I actually did an interview with Dr. Paik, who was going to present it the night before he first presented it at San Antonio Breast Meeting 2004, and we just saw what happened. And one of the things that happened there is, because nowadays they don't have to choose 1% because they have things like Oncotype. But one of the things that came out is it going to make a difference? And what the patient's attitude is. So like with Oncotype, if they already knew they were going to take chemo or they would never take right. chemo. So I guess I could ask you, you maybe someday you're going to have a medical, or you probably just had this happen, you have a medical oncologist show up as your patient. And that oncologist is going to know exactly what this data just showed. It may very well say, hey, how about doing a Signatera on me? And I'm guessing maybe you do it.
Yeah, I'm pretty liberal about doing this. I think more information is better, as long as we understand the sort of limitations. You know, if they haven't been fed into a prospective study, that might be harder to interpret. I personally, I've had experience already with a patient who had surgery, had high-risk features, but cell-free DNA negative. And, you know, I said, look, from what I know, about 12% chance of you relapsing with all these other high-risk features, I think it's higher. And even though he's cell-free DNA negative, we treated him. Had he been cell-free DNA positive, it would have been like a no-brainer to treat. And so I think that, you know, I don't know if that necessarily shows the utility of it, But I think it's certainly reassuring if someone has a very good response to neoadjuvant therapy and is cell-free DNA negative. And that comes back to our conversation earlier about, you know, EVP and giving adjuvant. So if you had someone in a complete response with negative cell-free DNA, and based on other trials, you know that the relapse risk is maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 8, you know, are you going to give the adjuvant in someone in a really otherwise really good position? So I think we need more data here. There's actually a prospective phase 3 trial through the Alliance called that's led by Matt Galsky, the Modern Trial, and that's prospectively using cell-free DNA to assign patients to either get Nivo or placebo if they're negative, or nivolumab versus a dual IO combo, nivolumab-relatimab if they're positive. So sort of really trying to escalate therapy for patients at highest risk and de-escalate therapy for patients at lowest risk. So that, I think, will provide a lot of info on this topic.
Yeah, and also, you know, you're talking about breast cancer patients who are willing to go through therapy for 1%. We've done some work looking at patients that says, there's a bunch of people like that, but there's also a bunch of people who don't want to get treatment, even for a pretty substantial benefit. Right. And this situation that you just described, where their MRD is negative, they're not completely out of the woods, but there's a lot less potential benefit, that could be enough to sway some people once, if they understand the numbers and want to hear them.
Yeah, I think it's very reasonable. Yeah, I think it's great to see these biomarkers actually helping to make and change treatment, and hopefully for the better. We need more data and more studies to make sure we're doing this in the right way.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Friedlander, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Cancer Conference Update.